There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesemundel. I'm your host. On today's program, true grassroots journalism and fake news. Two diametrically opposed entities. I'll be talking with Pauline Bartolone. She's alumna of WEFT in the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. And she's also now working for many grassroots news organizations. We're going to talk more about that. And then we're going to hear a little bit about fake news and how we're being sold corporate shillery under the guise of local news. You do want to stay tuned. And on the line, I should have Pauline Bartolone.
Hello.
There we go. Let's hope this all sticks together here.
I'm back.
And so most recently, you were down in New Orleans. In Louisiana, doing some reporting.
Louisiana.
Yeah, can you tell me more about that project?
Sure. I was in southwest Louisiana doing something about the Forgotten Storm, what people call it, the Forgotten Storm. That was Hurricane Rita. And that hit Cameron Parish really hard. Cameron Parish is Cameron County, but in Louisiana they call it Parish. And basically, you know, thousands of people are still homeless. They're in trailers. And people are talking a lot about Katrina, but the people in southwest Louisiana feel pretty forgotten about. And the stories are just amazing. I mean, houses that were on 13-foot pilings, they call them, were just barely washed away. Homes intact were found in marshland 20 miles up north. Just incredible things. 320 caskets were unearthed. So people are just now, 6 months after the storm, reburying the dead for the second time. So these people are, you know, just starting to get rid of the debris and trying to grapple with insurance companies so they can get the money to move on and rebuild back where their community was. And this is kind of in the heart of Cajun country, and Cajuns are very close-knit, you know, that they came to southwest Louisiana because they were displaced from Nova Scotia in France for political reasons. And so they came to southwest Louisiana, and they've always been, you know, settled there for hundreds of years, and this hurricane comes and people are scattered all over the place. So it's really kind of changed the fabric of Cajun community in this part of the country. So they call it Rita amnesia there, that people talk about Katrina a lot and not about Rita. So.
And so how did you come on to this story? How did you decide to go down there to southwest Louisiana?
Well, basically, after Katrina hit, I think everybody was really kind of scared about the hurricanes that were hitting the Gulf Coast. And I remember seeing the pictures of Rita, which was the strongest hurricane, I think, of this entire season. It was Category 5 in the Gulf, but when it hit landfall, it was only Category 3. But it scared the crap out of me, and I wanted to go down there immediately, and I wasn't able to go down there then. But I've always kind of remembered that storm, and it has been kind of in the show, the Katrina coverage. I mean, what's been going on in New Orleans is definitely something that needs to be brought to national attention and consistently talked about, a lot of the racial justice issues. But I don't know. I just never forgot about Hurricane Rita, and always wondered how they were faring in the aftermath of the hurricane.
And so, I mean, how did you go? Did you just decide to take a plane and bring some gear with you and plunge in? Did you have connections or contacts?
Well, I did it. I'm a graduate student at UC Berkeley Journalism School, and so I did it through a class. So usually I have just kind of like made the money and picked it to go, but I got it actually compensated for it by the school, so that was pretty nice. So now I'm in production mode. I just got back a few days ago, actually, and so now I'm going to be producing lots of radio programs about it. And the Cajun storytellers are incredible, some of the most open, honest people I've ever met in my entire life. So,
and so you are in graduate school. You're getting a master's degree in journalism?
I am, definitely.
But you've been doing journalism way before you decided to go to graduate school.
It's true. I started right there in Champaign-Urbana at the IMC and at West, and for that I'm really grateful. I think I was doing kind of teaching myself how to do journalism and letting others teach me for informal 4 years, and then I kind of ran out of things to teach myself. And so I want to bring social justice issues to a larger audience. I wanted to kind of become the media, or change the media within. But I'm still contributing a lot to KPFA and, you know, Free Speech Radio News and making contact and, you know, being in there when I can. But I just want to say that West is still my favorite community radio station. I mean, I was thinking back on it, and I've actually contributed more to WEFT in the past few years since I've been gone than I have to KPFA, which where I worked for 3 or 4 years. And I think it's really because whenever I'm back in Champaign-Urbana, I feel like my friends are on the radio. I feel like they're talking to me in my very own living room, and I always call in and I'm really excited when I go back to Champaign-Urbana and just to hear everybody on the radio. And I mean, you don't have people like Old Timer and KPFA out in California. You don't have like the Labor Hour. I don't even know if you still have Labor Hour on WFT anymore.
We sure do. We sure do.
You do. So, you know, the programming and the people and the voices and the community in Champaign-Urbana that you hear on West is really unique, and it's even more unique than any other community radio station that I've been involved with. You know, KPFA, I'd call it free speech radio. I wouldn't necessarily call it community radio because a lot of it is about, you know, personality and messaging and being an alternative voice. But it's, you don't really have that, like, your friend sitting with you in your living room kind of feel that you have on WFT. So just wanted to say that.
And I appreciate it. I've traveled around myself, and I visited several community stations. And I mean, obviously, West is my favorite because I'm here. And each one does have its sort of its own kind of culture, its own vibe. But the thing that always strikes me about WEFT is one thing is 8 to 5. You know, pretty much from 6 a.m. to somewhere 10 p.m. at night, the door is open. People can walk right in. And the studio's right up front. And while that can also cause problems, it's a unique sort of just access right from the street that I found to be very unique. And
right.
Even just compared to other stations around the country, great community stations. It's not, by no means am I criticizing them. It's just that little aspect of being really down there on the ground.
Right. And I think access is really the key word here. I mean, nowhere else, not even at KPFA, that is a community radio station, can you walk in, get training, be on the air, you know, talk with your friends on the radio. It really is, access is incredible. I mean, I had absolutely no training before I was on WFT, and I started doing the Monday Web Courier. I started producing Life in the Bike Lane, 5-minute drop-ins that I did at the IMC. And, you know, West was really open to that. And people, I would walk through the streets and people would say, hey, I heard Life in the Bike Lane this morning. It's really great. And it's just incredible. I miss West a lot.
And we miss you quite a bit. Pauline, you were, was it in Ecuador earlier this year?
I was. Yes. That was an 8-month-long project that I'm finally wrapping up on. But it was part of a a project about climate change in Ecuador and the disappearing tropical glaciers in the Andes and how it's going to threaten the water supply all throughout the Andes. Millions of people in the next 20 or 30 years will have serious water shortages. And I and a partner went to a town called Cotacachi in the northern Andes, which already lost their glacier. And we covered how they're having a lot of community conflicts over the shortage of water supplies. And it's funny because when we went down there, people were talking a lot about the changing rain patterns. And there's a serious drought when we were there as well. It hadn't rained a drop for 3 months, and it was 3 months into the rainy season. I mean, I don't know if you can imagine that, but like not raining for 3 months when, you know, agriculture farm workers depend on it. But, yeah, it's really incredible to see climate change impacting communities now. You know, everybody talks about global warming and how it'll affect people in the future, but it's happening now in a lot of places in the world, and communities are severely impacted.
And is this being covered at all in the Ecuadorian media? Do you know?
It's not really. It's not really on people's radar screen. It's sad. I mean, the country also doesn't have that many resources to deal with the problems. They know that the problem there, a lot of government officials are saying, you know, agricultural specialists and the climate change program saying the glaciers are disappearing, our rainy season is disappearing, and we can't really do anything about it, you know, because we're not the generators of global warming. We're not the ones who are polluting the earth. So, no, it's not really covered that much in the Ecuadorian media, and it's not being covered in the U.S. media, mm-hmm. as we all know. So,
and so that's why you decide. And so that's why you decide to go down to cover it.
Exactly.
And I guess, I mean, doing radio specifically, I mean, is comparatively inexpensive and easy, I mean, to do this sort of thing. What kind of equipment do you need to bring down?
You just need a mini disc recorder and a good microphone. I have a Sennheiser MD-46, but, you know, you can just buy a $10 microphone at Radio Shack and mm-hmm. you're ready to go. Buy a plane ticket and you're ready to go. I mean, I choose to do radio because it's so conducive to storytelling. And people's voices, and that's what WEFT is about, too, is storytelling and getting people's voices and opinions out in the air that you wouldn't hear anywhere else. I mean, the space in radio to hear people's stories directly from the person themselves, there's really no other space, and even in print or in broadcast, and that's what I think is so unique about radio.
That's why I've been doing it, and it's such an efficient medium. It's that with such minimal equipment, you can go off and bring back people's voices and people's stories and broadcast them via either a single community station or programs like syndicated programs like Making Contact or Free Speech Radio News. It's an amazing thing. It's incredibly efficient. So little money can go to so much communication. And we are so lucky here in the U.S. especially because we do have as many community radio stations as we do. It as rare a commodity as it is in the United States, it's an even rarer commodity in most of the rest of the world, including a lot of Western countries.
Right, right. And a lot of people in rural communities in Latin America, at least, and in the U.S., people depend on radio to get their news. They don't depend on print. They don't watch TV for their news. They listen to the radio because they can, you know, radio is the only medium that you can multitask. You can do other things. You can work. You can cook and listen to the radio and get your news. And that's another reason why I'm an avid radio listener.
Yeah, last week I talked to some of the Immokalee workers from Florida who have gotten their own low-power FM station, and they mentioned how, yes, they're able to come in the evenings, work during the day or come in during the evenings, or different people can come in and use the radio, and they don't, you know, have to read, and people can listen to the radio while doing their nightly chores, and it helps them to organize and to really make sure they all know what's up and what's all in their best interests. It's an amazing medium. Pauline, I hope you keep up the good work. I'm really looking forward to hearing you again. Every time I've heard you on Free Speech Radio News sitting here waiting to do my program, I'm always like, that's Pauline. I know her. She started here at WEFT. We're so proud of her. We're so glad you're doing all that great work.
Thank
and of course,
you.
I look forward to seeing you again sometime, I hope, in the near future.
Yeah, definitely. I always say someday maybe I'll move back to Champaign-Urbana. I love it there. But congratulations to you for being on 10 stations. That's incredible.
Well, thank you very much. It's little bit by little bit. If it weren't for the opportunity to do it here at WEFT, I don't think it ever would occur to me. Not probably
right.
Never would have occurred. So the opportunity's been great. So
exactly.
I think it's been
people
good to both of us. Yes. Well, thanks again, Pauline, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care, Paul. Okay,
bye-bye. And that was Pauline Bartolone. She is an alumna of WEFT and the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. She has reported for the National Radio Project for KPFA, a Pacifica station. She has reported for Free Speech Radio News, which is heard here on WEFT and community radio stations around the world. And we are talking a bit about community radio, grassroots journalism, and the importance it plays in this world, especially of greatly consolidating media. There was a special bloggers conference call held April 6th, and that was sponsored by Free Press and by the Center for Media and Democracy on PR Watch to talk about the research which they have done, which has revealed a whole series of so-called news reports put together by various PR agents and corporations distributed to local news stations, which they then turn into news stories. They do this by overdubbing their local reporters' voices, sometimes even dropping in their faces on the news to make it look like that they produced it themselves, only they didn't, and usually they're shilling for a single corporate cause. So give us a little bit of intro on this. We're going to hear from John Stauber, who is the director of PR Watch and the Center for Media and Democracy.
The Center for Media and Democracy was founded 13 years ago. We're at www.prwatch.org, and our mission is investigating, exposing, reporting on corporate and government PR spin and propaganda campaigns. I call fake TV news the biggest plagiarism scandal in American journalism because it's been going on now for at least 20 years. It's a dirty, huge secret between the PR industry and every TV network and commercial station in America, who are offered every year thousands of fake news stories, which they either use and brand as their own reporting, fake news, when they're actually news stories prepared by usually ex-journalists now working in the PR industry and putting together biased news stories with money from companies like in this release, Pfizer, for instance, that promotes Pfizer's products, but are then taken by so-called TV journalists and aired as if they were actual news reporting rather than corporate propaganda disguised as news reporting. This has been widespread and undisclosed for a long, long time. What's really incredible is that Diane Fersetta and Dan Price of our organization, over the last 10 months of intensive digging, were able to capture a little less than 1% of all the VNRs released during that period. And that formed the basis of our report and our analysis. I think it's up now, and you can see for yourselves that in these 36 captured VNRs aired by 77 different stations, every one of these instances involves taking this fake news, dressing it up to look like real reporting, and fooling the audience. No one has ever done a report like this before. We're very happy to have been able to do it. We're very happy to be working with our activist partner, Free Press, in generating a no-fake news campaign to try to require mandatory labeling every frame of all commercially provided footage so, frankly, people can see whether it's news or whether it's Memorex, whether it's real journalism or whether it's fake TV news.
And that is John Stauber. He is director for PR Watch, talking about research, which his organization, the Center for Media and Democracy, has done, showing how corporations and PR agencies have been placing so-called video newsreels, which are really commercials disguised as news, onto local television stations around the country. We're going to hear Dan Price, also from that organization, who's going to tell us more about these video newsreels.
That it was bad at the Center for Media and Democracy, but it wasn't until we really started doing this project that we saw the true scope of just how pervasive this fake news is. I really encourage you to go to prwatch.org to look at the specific examples, to see some of the things, just the nitty-gritty details of some of these really insidious uses of fake news. We have a whole variety of stuff. We have a software company planting a VNR just like nationally pretty much through Tribune Broadcasting. We have General Motors, three different ones, and three different agendas on behalf of the company where they planted complete fake news and stations would just run it, cut and paste. We have things as silly as National Pancake Week VNR, sponsored by Bisquick. I mean, it just runs the gamut. But one thing that's consistent throughout all these examples, and we have 98 total instances of fake news documented on this site, the consistent part is that the TV news has worked in tandem with these VNR companies to basically pass off this corporate-sponsored news as their own journalism. And what's great about the site is you can see the before and after video. So just watch the original VNR, compare it to the newscast, and see how horribly, horribly similar they are, and notice the complete lack of disclosure on behalf of the news groups. It is really, we knew it was bad, but it is really bad, and you can see for yourself.
And that is Dan Price from PR Watch and the Center for Media Democracy describing video news releases, these commercials disguised as news playing on local TV stations. And they do play on TV stations owned by companies like Nexstar and Sinclair Broadcasting, which both own stations in the Central Illinois area. Sinclair owns channels 15 and 20, which are ABC affiliates, and Nexstar owns channels 3 and 49, our CBS affiliate, a very high power station here in Champaign-Urbana, and channel 49 out of Springfield, which is a UPN affiliate. Both these companies have been identified by Free Press and the Center for Media and Democracy to be huge abusers of video news reels. And so finally, we're going to hear from Jonathan Adelstein. He is a commissioner with the FCC. He's a Democrat, and he will talk a bit about his view on these video news reels and what the FCC can do about it.
We are just really blown away by this study. It's documents what I've been concerned about and talking about. We've heard a lot of allegations of VNRs, but this is just an arsenal of smoking guns. There is so much evidence of a problem here that the likes of which we've never seen. It was quite an enterprising effort to come up with the number of them. I mean, frankly, I would have expected it would have been surprising you put all this effort in if you'd found a few of them that you're able to track through from raw VNR into a little local TV news story. But here they found time after time, the local news stations are just letting them go right through as if they're news, unfiltered or barely filtered, with no disclosure to the public. that's not just a violation of FCC rules, it's a violation of their own internal guidelines. You may have already gotten into this, but the Radio and Television News Directors Association has these internal guidelines saying these things need to be disclosed. So they're not following their own guidelines. They're not following basic journalistic ethics. But my role here is to say they're also not following the law. The sponsorship ID rules, sometimes known as payola rules because they were set up to combat payola, require that whenever somebody gives viable consideration anywhere along the line of production to get something onto broadcasting, that they need to disclose that up the line of production so the broadcaster can tell the public this piece was paid for by GM or by, this company that makes the eczema cream or whatever, Motorola, whatever it is that is paying for the particular VNR. And it appears that there was no disclosure here. Quite the opposite. Rather than disclosing the source, they actually disguise it as if it was their own, as if it was their own news operation. They go just the opposite length. The reason they're doing this is because it's very expensive to produce real news, and they need to fill what we call the news hole. You know, they got to spend a half an hour filling up local news, and rather than spending an expensive crew out to go and do a real job of finding out what's happening in local communities, it's easier to take some prepackaged pap and just sell it off as if it's your own piece. Maybe have your people do a voiceover. You don't even have to pay writers for the script because they're using exactly the same scripts that the PR company has prepared with their own subliminal or overt messages in them. And so from the FCC's perspective, the only thing they need to do is disclose it to the public. But from their perspective, if they disclose it, that would defeat the whole purpose of pretending like this fake news is real.
And that's FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein talking about video newsreels, corporate commercials disguised as local news, and some of the FCC's regulatory view on it. If you want to learn more about it, if you want to see some of these actual commercials, it's pretty amazing. Go to sourcewatch.org. Go to also, you can go to freepress.org, or you can go to prwatch.org, and they have these. You can read the full report, which was released on April 6th. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.